Welcome to Lightning in a Bottle, a podcast series for owners and key stakeholders in privately held companies and the professionals that surround them. My name is Josh Pottinger, and together with Jason Georgianis, we run ATX Wealth Partners here at UBS. Jason and I have been teamed up now for over 20 years, and each of us has over 25 years of experience in the financial services industry. Our goal is to bring real-world perspectives to help you prepare yourself, your family, and your business for the day that you decide to monetize some or all of your ownership position in the company. Throughout this series, we will provide our own thoughts as well as interview key people along the way. Feel free to email us at atxwealthpartners@ubs.com. And with that, let's go ahead and get started. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. This is Josh Pottinger and my good friend and business partner, Jason Georgianis. He's traveling in Idaho at the moment, so it's going to be me today. Today's actually a special afternoon for multiple reasons. The first one is this is our 20th episode of the Lightning in a Bottle podcast series. And the second item here is the fact that I've got a wonderful guest on our show today, Sean Hutchinson. Sean, are you there?
I am. Hi, Josh.
Good. Sean, are you in Colorado?
I am.
Okay.
I'm working from home today. It's great. We're having one of our last warm days before it starts to snow on us.
Ah, good. Good deal. I was in Newport Beach, Rhode Island this past weekend with my wife visiting a client out there, and we had some nice cool and rainy weather. It was a nice reprieve from the heat that we have here in Texas. So, well, Sean, thanks for coming on today. So for the audience out there, I'll give you a little bit of some background on Sean. We're going to be the topic of conversation today. It's all about value acceleration and what to do as a business owner, things just key considerations to think about in terms of how to accelerate the value of your company and just some best practices out there. So Sean's been at this for a long time. He's been 25 years plus years in the business, and he's talked to a ton of business owners across the country, and he's heard their stories of success and their struggle, and has really taken all of that information and been able to organize it and use it to help consult and guide other business owners out there. And you know, as a business value growth and transition expert, obviously it's important to be talking to those professional advisors out there, the people that are actually advising these business owners. So he's founded 5 companies. He's actually a business owner himself, and he's the third generation heir to his family's 67-year-old custom millwork manufacturing business. So he's got some real-world perspective on running a family business. He is also a certified exit planning advisor and a certified merger and acquisition advisor, and serves on the board of directors for 3 private companies. So I would have to say Sean is doing the deed out there, walking the walk. So Sean, thank you again for coming on today. All right, so we're going to talk all about value acceleration. We just had you in Austin not too long ago, and unfortunately I got sick for the roundtable discussion, but Jason was there. We had some tremendous feedback for that conversation. So for those that weren't able to be there today, we're going to try to cover some of the topics that were covered that night. So let's kick it off here. So Sean, I know you talk to and you work with a lot of business owners across the country who have and are currently navigating some turbulent times. What are you hearing from them these days? How are they managing?
It's kind of a mixed bag. It's interesting. So, you know, you can make the argument that some of it is industry specific, because there is obviously, if you look at the tech industry versus the manufacturing industry, you're going to get different perspectives on the economy. Those are very, very distinct sorts of industries, and the businesses within them operate on very different metrics. But I think in general, what I'm seeing in business owners is some anxiety that would be expected because we're in such a volatile and uncertain time. It's trying to make big decisions in this kind of environment is really, really difficult to do. And I think one of the concerns that I have and that I've heard from business owners is in times like these, they feel like they're stuck. They feel like they can't make good decisions, or they're even afraid to make decisions in general, big decisions at least. So their world kind of narrows down, and they're willing to make incremental decisions, but as a result of that, they may miss an opportunity just because of their mindset, right? It's hard when you're experiencing a lot of stress. And I think owners really are experiencing a lot of stress more than they normally do. I mean, owning a business is generally stressful, never really goes away. But I think it's heightened right now. And when you're in that mode, when your brain is kind of in that fight or flight stage, then making decisions and making good decisions can be really, really difficult. So I think anxiety and a little bit of stuckness is part of it. From a business perspective, it's interesting. I think business, at least private business owners, are fairly optimistic right now. And let me sort of try to get at what I think is going on, because it's a pretty complex conversation in some ways. So we see the news, right, from the public markets. By the way, this is maybe a conversation for another day, but there is, for a long time, there has been a debate about how different is the public market from the private capital market, right? Are private businesses really comparable to public businesses and vice versa? And my position for a long time has been, you can get a little bit out of comparing a privately held business to a publicly held business. At least you can get kind of some interesting benchmarks here and there. But for the most part, the way that a public company has to operate, the access to cheaper capital, the bigger balance sheet, and their marketplace is just so different from running a private business that I think the two, especially in this time, are just almost unrecognizable when you compare the two of them. There just isn't a whole lot. So when we talk about the volatility of the stock market, for instance, it would be too easy, I think, to say, well, that volatility that might have a lot of people nervous who have investments in the market, which are not a huge percentage of people here in the United States, it would be easy to interpret that as everybody's got to be feeling that way. Everybody's got to be either pessimistic or optimistic or somewhere in the middle. But I think private business owners have a lot more control over how their businesses operate. They can scale back, they can scale up, they can kind of keep it in neutral for a while, and they can operate in ways that help them manage volatility differently. Their decisions can be, in some ways, really positively insular. They can kind of seal themselves off a little bit from broader market conditions. So when I talk to our clients and other business owners, it hasn't been business as usual, but they've been able to achieve a certain level of stability, I think, that even though they're stressed, they're confident that their business will survive. They're confident that their business can continue to grow. And part of that, for a lot of the folks that we work with who are, I would say, kind of late stage baby boomer business owners, look, this is not their first rodeo. This is not the first time that they've been in a difficult economy or an uncertain time. In fact, I talked to one of them not too long ago and I said, do you think that when COVID kind of hit, that it would have been possible for us to, in some ways, predict how dangerous that was going to be for the economy, right? And they said, oh, in our business, we saw it coming right away because we had put into place systems that would help us see and manage risk of all different kinds as a result of the Great Recession. We promised ourselves that we were never going to be caught off guard again. So they proactively managed all of these different risk scenarios. And yeah, COVID-19 is something of a black swan event, right, as far as risk goes. But they were prepared to handle it, I guess, as just another risk event. It was very odd. I guess I wouldn't say it's odd, but he was so calm about it. Like, well, this is just the price of admission. This is what it's like in business. You just have to be prepared. So in general, they're in financially pretty good shape. I mean, business owners have built up pretty good balance sheets over the last several years prior to COVID. They continue to be pretty healthy and conservative on their financial management. Interest rate rises. I mean, everybody's kind of freaked out about that. But a lot of our clients, they don't hold a whole lot of debt. And if they have a line of credit, for instance, if they've got to use their line of credit, they use it very conservatively and they pay it off right away. So they're not really facing cost of money issues. I don't think that's what's on their mind. I think it's more supply chain. And the big issue for them right now that's causing a huge amount of anxiety is people. Can they get the people to grow? Can they keep good people? What are they going to have to do competitively? Are they going to have to increase their benefits? Are they going to have to increase compensation? Those things obviously affect margin and profit and cash flow, and that's on their mind for sure.
So just to kind of recap there, Sean, I think you talked about owners having some level of anxiety and some stuckness, just with all of the overarching issues that we're faced with today with rates and obviously what's going on in the Middle East and Ukraine and just all the geopolitical issues and everything, right? And the threat of a potential recession and slowing down and a slowdown in the economy. But in general, owners are fairly optimistic. And the fact that private owners have more control over the various levers of their company, that helps give them an advantage to the public markets out there.
I think so.
That are having to report to the public every quarter, and they're bound by their quarterly numbers. And obviously there's a whole another level of compliance and reporting that goes along with that, that private owners don't have. And we're seeing a lot of public to private transitions out there as well.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So the other key thing that you mentioned too is basically preparation is key. And learning from the lessons of the past. And that's helped these individuals. So,
I think so.
Good. Okay. Your focus is really on helping owners build and accelerate the enterprise value of the company. And it's usually in preparation for some kind of ownership transaction. So let's talk about some of the more impactful value drivers and where owners should invest their time and energy.
I think I have four to talk about, and they're kind of broad, but let me try to make them as specific as possible. So it's kind of consistent with what we were just talking about. One of the major value drivers right now, and I think overall, it doesn't really matter whether it's now or into the future, it's always there, is the ability to manage risk. So broadly speaking, company-specific risk, what would be referred to as company-specific risk, is the primary driver of value in a private business, right? So it's kind of like what's under the hood. The car could look great on the surface, right? I mean, you could put two cars next to one another. They both look great. They're both kind of the same model. As far as you can tell, everything's running fine. But it's kind of like getting that Carfax report, right?
Right.
So one of them is more wounded than the other when you really start to check into it. The risk kind of lives under the hood. It lives on the interior of the business. It can be hard to see, and it can be hard to manage. I think companies and owners and their teams, if they have great teams, if they're focused on risk management, they're able to get through difficult times. And even if they don't necessarily thrive, they're not going to go off a cliff by any means. But it also, risk management, active risk management, really gives you a different way of looking at your business, right? So if we look at the three ways to build enterprise value, to increase enterprise value, you can increase earnings, which I think is where a lot of owners focus probably the majority of their time, right? It's in their income statement. How can I drive sales? How can I control cost of goods? How can I lower my operating expenses? What drops to the bottom line? And of course, as a business owner myself, I'm always focused on that. And I'm always trying to figure out how to grow. Mm-hmm. But the biggest impact is really that pretty robust, many things go into the risk bucket. If you can manage that effectively, risk goes down, multiple of EBITDA on the valuation goes up. So the multiple is increased by risk management, and the EBITDA is increased by the growth metrics that we're talking about, increasing earnings. But then there's the third way to increase enterprise value, which is to really be and position the company as best in class, know the benchmarks, understand what your competition is doing, being able to communicate your best in class position into the marketplace in a number of different ways. I mean, if you're a really, really good company, my opinion is talk about it all the time. So focusing on risk management, being able to, I would say, invest in stability. Any kind of stability that you can find, especially today, is going to be a major value driver, right? I think you should focus on margins. So one of the danger signs that we see sometimes in companies is that they may have growing sales, but their margins, especially their gross margin, right? So after cost of goods sold, that gross margin is suffering. It starts to drop. that indicates to us that even though they're finding customers and they're able to garner, they're able to net dollars into the company, they've got a discount to do it, or their cost of delivering the goods is going up. That could be supply chain issue or commodities issue, whatever it might be. It could also be labor. So managing margins so that they don't become volatile, or it doesn't appear that you're having to discount your prices in order to drive growth. I mean, as you and I are sitting here talking, Tesla in the public market is being hammered because they both lost market share and their margins degraded because they were having to discount a lot of stuff in order to kind of keep their, well, at least they thought they were going to keep their market position, but they got hammered. So, and that's kind of the perfect storm, right? We couldn't sell anymore. We've lost market share and we had to discount to even achieve a worse position than we were in. So margins are really important to manage actively. Third, years ago in the Harvard Business Review, there was an article called Roaring Out of the Recession. And it was all about what companies did during bad economic times, during recessions, right? In order to prep themselves for moving quickly out of the recession and gaining competitive advantage, right? So moving out of the recession faster than their competitors did, who kind of hunkered down during those poor economic conditions, kind of pulled their horns in. And then it wasn't until the recession was easing up that they began to think about, okay, well, let's take a breather here. Now we're beginning to formulate our strategy. So companies that roared out of the recession did one thing that I think was really, really important, and it just speaks to me today, which is they invested in people. So instead of firing people, they actually went out into the market and they found the best people who were being fired by other people, right? Being fired by their competitors. And they started to bring them in, knowing that they were going to have to float some of that cost in order to keep those people. But they felt like it was going to provide them with a competitive advantage and that would allow them to move faster once the economic conditions eased up. The other thing that they did was they invested in training. So another sort of metric of how you invest in your people. A lot of companies in poor economic conditions will stop training. They'll zero out their training budget for some reason. These companies did exactly the opposite. They used the time that they had to hire good people and then train them really well, make them better, more productive members of their team. And then I think on the people side also, investing in great leadership is always the sign of a more valuable company. And why is that? One, owners who invest in great leadership teams, the company is less dependent on the owner by virtue of the fact that they've said, I want a great leadership team. I'm going to give them the authority to run this company. I'm going to step back. My job, kind of like Andy Grove at Intel, used to be the CEO of Intel, said the job of the CEO is training. So that owner becomes a mentor. They become a trainer for the leadership team, but they're transferring authority. They're transferring knowledge that the company is not so dependent on them. And we know that owner dependency, quite frankly, when the company can't operate well without the owner there in an active role, it's less valuable. It's a big value killer. So if I see investments in people and investments in great leadership teams, I know that the company is going to be moving in the right direction and be able to thrive even in poor economic conditions, but certainly afterwards.
Okay, so we talked about increasing earnings, obviously, investing or the ability to manage risks, and then positioning yourself and acting as best in class. And part of that is focusing on margins, driving revenue, but keeping an eye on margins, hiring good people during those difficult times, investing in training and great leadership, all hallmarks of a great business that can continue to accelerate in value.
That's right. We call that being the employer of choice. So if you're the employer of choice in your industry, and if you can keep your people, even though they may be getting offers from your competitors to earn more money at better compensation, if your people are saying, no, I'd rather work here, and it goes beyond compensation, it goes into the culture, the way that I'm treated, the opportunities that I'm given, so on and so forth, that's an employer of choice. And being an employer of choice is a huge advantage today. And I think it's not just an advantage in tight labor markets like we have. it's an advantage that it's undeniably a value driver. And those companies at the end of the day are going to be the ones that successfully transition. If they want to sell to a third party, they're going to be top of the list. If they want to execute on a management team buyout or something like that, it's going to be possible to do because they've got a great leadership team that can find the money to do it, can be backed by private equity or can borrow money to buy the company ultimately. So it's all kind of part of an ecosystem of value drivers. I don't think there's one thing in particular that's going to absolutely make the difference. I think you have to pay attention to a whole lot of things, but they're all related. There's no question.
So what would be sort of like the top 3 to 5 risks, like to summarize for folks out there?
One way to think about risks is to call them value killers or to call them headwinds, whatever kind of language resonates the most. So one risk is to get too dependent on a small number of customers. So generally speaking, you don't want more than maybe 10 to 15% of your top line revenue to come from any single customer. You certainly don't want to be in a position, say, that 50% of your revenues come from 3 customers or something like that, because I think that's probably obvious to most people. Certainly looking at it through the eyes of an investor, if I'm thinking about buying a company or investing in a company, I am always concerned that, hey, if one of those big customers happens to decide to do business with somebody else, and it happens all the time, how is that going to affect my return on investment? But how does that play out in terms of risk management? There are some layers within that that I think are important to point out. One, in order to get those big customers, you may have had to discount your prices, right? It may have been, I mean, everybody's going after those big customers in some ways, right? They're whales. Everybody wants to land a whale. So you may have had to discount as you sold. So your margins start to suffer. You may have to add, if you're a manufacturer, for instance, you may have had to invest in additional manufacturing capacity. So you took capital risk in order to realize the value of that customer. You may have had to add people. So you're taking some people risk. Just related to that one account, just that one sale, that one customer is causing you to make big moves that you might not have otherwise made, and making those moves for less money at the end of the day. It's good for your top line. It may not be good for your margins. It may not drop as much net profit to the bottom line. So you end up kind of suffering as you move down that stack in the income statement. Top line looking good, there's growth. But when you dig into the growth, it's kind of infested with a number of different risks that may be invisible unless you kind of stop and think about it, right? Now, there may be a really good strategic reason to land that whale, because it might get you into a segment of the marketplace, for instance, that you hadn't been able to access before. We often in sales talk about what's the next right customer, not just what's the next customer, what's the next sale, what's the next right sale that's aligned with the strategy, that's aligned with our strategy for growth. So you have to be highly strategic about it. One risk to be really aware of today is how you treat your people, right? What kind of culture are you building? I've seen owners kind of consistently these days, it seems, kind of create an adversarial relationship with employees because the employees may be coming to them negotiating for higher compensation, for instance, or refusing to enhance their benefits package, even though it's clear that their competitors are doing that. Making those kinds of decisions, you don't want to do anything rashly, obviously. But if you want to be a great employer and a place where people really want to work, you're in a competitive environment for people. You're not just in a competitive environment for customers. You're in a competitive environment for people. And it's interesting. I've worked with owners that are more than willing to compete for the customer, but they're not willing to compete for the people. And yet, in the same sentence, they'll say, people are our greatest asset. Well, all right, but put your money where your mouth is in some ways, right? So don't create people risk for yourself when you don't have to. There are ways that you can, beyond money, that you can create a great culture and great opportunity for your employees and not set up an adversarial relationship with them that would ultimately cause good people to leave the company and not so great people potentially to stay with the company. So the people risk, the customer risk, And I think there's always this risk of owner dependency that's kind of lurking in the background. I think that that comes down to a smooth transition of authority from the owner to other people who are well prepared to run the company. It's also what I would call a knowledge risk. So if the owner hangs on to knowledge that other people are going to need to be successful, and owners know a lot about their business, right? They know more about it probably than anybody else is ever going to know about it. So they have a lot in their head that needs to be downloaded, not only to other people, but into the way that the company is actually run. If those downloads haven't happened, if the transfer of knowledge hasn't happened, then the transfer of authority can't happen either. It would be premature to do it unless the people have the knowledge to be on hand to be successful. So I've seen a lot of situations where owners kind of transfer the authority, but don't transfer the knowledge, or they kind of keep some of the authority and keep some of the knowledge. So they just transfer halfway. I think that that's a huge risk, actually, in the development of a management team. They just can't be successful. And then the owner feels like they've got to step back in and make decisions and micromanage because it isn't going the way that they want it to be going. So I think that owner dependency and customer concentration are the two biggest value killers in any business. And watch for anything that has to do with that, or question your strategy, question your sales team about what the next right customer is, and make sure that that's aligned with your strategy. And I think agility is worth a lot, honestly. I think being able to function in an uncertain environment and be agile, be aware, that's a great skill. It takes a really good team to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a great breakdown of the different risks there. Which one of them, when you talk about knowledge risk, I have to think about the importance of having processes and systems in place to document and memorialize that knowledge.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, you're part of a family business that's moving into its third generation, which is your generation. Third generation family-owned business is a pretty rare event. You also work with a lot of family businesses. So what is it about family businesses that are different?
The weight of history, I think.
Yeah.
The relationships are fundamentally different. If you've got family members that are working together in a business, they bring, it's not necessarily baggage, it's just a history comes in the door with them, a certain characteristic of their relationships with one another. It's just different than any other employee relationship in the company, which makes it really difficult to define roles and expected contributions well. The boundaries, the sort of respect for boundaries that you would normally see, let's say between a non-family chief operating officer and a non-family chief financial officer, if you're going to kind of cite it within the leadership team, the respect that you would see for boundaries, even though it can be a little bit weak sometimes, it's there. It's absolutely there. So the dynamic between those two non-family members is going to be absolutely different than if two family members, let's say a brother and a sister, are serving in those two roles. They have to be really, really conscious that when they're at work, they have to almost create an uncomfortable and rather artificial boundary so that they understand their distinct roles, their distinct authority. And they can also kind of negotiate, how is it that in a professional environment, we are going to work together so that our contributions make the business better, treat our employees well, create value for our customers, so on and so forth. But so often in those situations, there's kind of a respect for authority until there isn't. And then the whole boundary starts to break down and all kinds of other things just sort of seep into the story. And all of a sudden, we're having conversations about things that happened 7 years ago that really don't have very much to do with what's going on in the business. So it's really easy for the perspectives to get distorted. That's kind of on the negative dynamic side, maybe. I think on the positive side of family business, we can also draw on our history and presumably our love for one another to get through difficult times together in ways probably that non-family members can't. We have to be careful about it, obviously. I mean, it's possible to mistake that kind of emotional connection for good management, because it's not always. But it can help us feel supported when we're going through a terrible time, when we're having a bad day, being able to go to a family member and have that discussion in a positive, kind of constructive way, I find is easier than going to somebody else who's a non-family member and kind of sharing that with them. The vulnerability involved in having those conversations is a familiar kind of family dynamic interaction where it's not so common to have that level of vulnerability, I think, with non-family members in a business. There's some concern around that probably. So the boundaries can work both ways, right? They can be very weak when they need to be strong, and they can be pretty strong when they need to be a little bit weaker. But I think family businesses are fundamentally different for those reasons. The relationships, just the mechanics of the relationships, are different. That said, I think that it is rare, right, for a family business to get to Gen 3 and Gen 4 and beyond. It's very rarefied air by the time you get to Gen 4. Only about 3% of family businesses have survived that far. And I think there are potentially a lot of reasons for that. But one big one that comes up for me, and I think it is sort of unique to family businesses in the ways that it can happen, is the transfer of authority. We talked about that in the risk category, right? The transfer of authority from the predecessor generation to the successor generation can be very, very messy, right? Because it's a transfer from, in some cases, parent to child. So we have a framework, I guess, for where authority lies within a family sometimes that can carry over into the business. And when it's time for that authority to be transferred, it can be hard on both generations, both the giving generation and the receiving generation, because it sort of rebalances the relationship where it might be one thing outside the business and now all of a sudden it's something very different inside the business. You have to do it with a lot of planning. You have to be very conscious of the dynamic while it's happening. And you also have to be careful if you're a predecessor generation, like my dad, for instance. If I were running the business, he would have to be super careful about not interfering, I guess, stepping back in and kind of taking back what had already been granted in terms of the ability to run the business, because that obviously for me or for any successor generation would be devastating in a lot of different ways, emotionally and otherwise. And make it very difficult to lead the business if other people in the business saw predecessor generation stepping back in and saying, I don't like the way that you did that. Now I'm overriding your decision. That it just can't happen, because it relegates the younger generation to being in what we call a custodial role. In other words, you should just be running this business the way that we've always run it, not the way that you think it could be run in the future. And I think we all need to admit that younger generation has skills and perspectives that are really valuable in today's fast moving world, right? The agony of the pace of business these days, the pace of technology, for instance, for most of us, we just can't catch up. We can't keep up with it. But some of the younger generation are perfectly comfortable in that kind of velocity. They're just fine with it. So they can make quicker decisions. They can get information quicker. They can crowdsource problem solving through the web, through social media. They have skills, they have techniques that a lot of us who may be a little bit older don't have. And that can be really valuable for growth and positioning and building enterprise value. So it's not going to be done the way that it was done in the past. That's the point of transferring authority and transferring knowledge. Some of it's going to be useful and some of it won't. As the predecessor generation transferring, I have to be totally comfortable with the fact that once I'm out, unless I'm asked to help. That's the only way that it can work. And that's kind of unique to family businesses as well, right? You'd have that conversation in a non-family business to a certain degree, but you wouldn't have it in the same way that you do in a family business. It's kind of fraught.
Yeah, there's definitely a whole nother level of complexity when it comes to the family businesses out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important to note that the great majority of businesses in the United States are family owned. Even among publicly traded companies, there's a significantly family owned component to them, right? Those founding families, in a lot of cases, still have a significant stake in the company that they founded, even though it's publicly traded, and they can have a lot of influence. So family business is kind of a time honored tradition in the United States. Yes, it's complex, but it can drive a lot of business success So we tend to focus on the layered, complex, very nuanced family dynamics, which are very real. But I think if we took a good look, I'm sure someone out there probably has, but if we had a deep look at the performance of family-owned businesses in an industry versus non-family-owned, I think we'd find pretty consistently that the family-owned businesses outperform their peers.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Sean, let's transition here as we wrap up our conversation. Let's talk about the 7 ways to exit a private business and also the 8th way, which you've mentioned as a hybrid transition. Can you explain and kind of share a story for us?
The 7 ways that we talk about, I'm going to take IPOs off the table. I mean, that's obviously a way to transition a business, but it's pretty rare. It's a small percentage. So we organize the traditional transition options into internal and external. So on the internal side, if you're a family business, you may have an intergenerational family transition option, right? It's not always there. Even if you have kids or grandkids, they may not want to own the business. They may not be a good fit for the business. So just because there is a family component to it doesn't mean that that's automatic. About 50% of family-owned businesses want to transition to the next generation, but only about 30% end up doing it for a lot of reasons. So also in the internal category, employee ownership, management team buyouts, partnership transfers, often those are governed by buy-sell arrangements. So they can be very closely regulated, if you will, according to the agreements between the partners. By the way, if anyone's listening who is in a partnership and doesn't have a buy-sell agreement, you should red flag that and light a fire because it's a big risk. Mm-hmm. On the external transition side, selling to a third party, so selling outright, probably to a competitor or somebody else in a particular industry, or even people who want to get into the industry by acquiring, it's going to go to another company most of the time. There's also the financial buyer, which would be somebody like a private equity group or a family. Their motivations may be a little bit different. Private equity groups, when they buy a business, they may buy a majority, but they expect the owner, I think, to leave some chips on the table, so to speak. They want the management team to be part of that. So they're buying for not strictly, but primarily financial reasons, where a strategic buyer would be looking at it, I think, through a slightly different lens. Obviously, they want a financial return, but they have other reasons for buying the company. You could recapitalize the company. In other words, get some new money onto the balance sheet, right? And use that money for growth. That may be kind of a transaction that doesn't really allow the owner to take all the chips off the table. They may take some, but a recapitalization really is more about getting new money into the company, either equity or debt, a combination of the two, for growth. And then the dreaded orderly liquidation is the last kind of bullet point on that external column. Frankly, sometimes that's just the only option. That's the way to go, is to orderly liquidate the company. But it also, for really asset-heavy businesses like rolling stock companies, train cars and things like that, or airlines, whatever it might be, if you've got a lot of heavy assets, orderly liquidation might actually yield more than trying to sell the enterprise itself, because margins can be really low. So those are kind of the major options, with the exception of IPO. Now, when you were talking about hybrid transitions, we actually see this, and we kind of design from time to time transition plans that take this into account. And I'll share a story to illustrate what we mean by hybrids. So in general, hybrid transitions are using more than one exit option type, which we just talked about, to engineer a transition over a longer period of time. So the story I'll share is of a heavy equipment company, the 4th generation company, family company, owned by 4 brothers who were pretty far apart in age. The youngest brother was 62, the oldest brother was 79. So that kind of age spread among partners typically begs some questions about differing motivations for actually exiting a company, right? So the older brothers in this particular case had more wealth. They had accumulated more wealth over the years. They lived longer. And in one case, they'd just done better planning. So because they had wealth outside of the business, their motivation for selling the business, they weren't as strong on that point, right? They had enough money. So they were more focused on how do we get it from generation four to generation five? The middle brother, after the two oldest, the middle brother, he didn't have a whole lot of money. He was going through a divorce. It was really acrimonious. So he had that to take into account. And he really was more motivated by money because he needed it. But he also wanted a continuing role in the company because he didn't want to stop working. And then the younger brother, who was 62, he actually was the CEO of the company. And he didn't want to exit at all. He felt like he had a long runway. He wanted his sons to continue to work in the company and maybe have some equity in the future. He didn't want to transition any of his equity at the time that the other brothers did. So you can imagine, because of those factors, you can't just go in and say, well, you guys should sell the company, right? There was no real way to have that conversation. It was off the table right away because you were never going to convince the younger brothers that that was the way to go. The company had 250 employees. They really wanted to treat their employees well. They had become interested in employee ownership, in particular doing what an ESOP, an employee stock ownership program, as a possible way of exiting. But they had gotten bad advice somewhere along the way. No one had ever said to them, hey, if you do an ESOP, you don't have to sell 100% of the company to the ESOP. You can sell, you only have to sell 30% to start the process, and you'll still get the tax benefits at that level. When we talked to them about that, they acted like the whole universe had essentially was black and white and all of a sudden was in full Technicolor. They were like, well, wait a minute, that means that we could not just do partial ESOP, but we could also probably create some equity for our management leadership team. We could keep some equity for the family and an intergenerational transfer. And so we started to have a conversation about using different options and combining them, but also creating kind of a staged exit so the older brothers could start to exit the company before the younger brothers did, which was another kind of revelation for them because their assumption all along had been, we all have to get out at the same time. And when we showed them kind of what walking through a bit of a kind of a laddered exit, if you will, would be able to do and kind of meet the expectations, their different frameworks, right? Their different motivations. We could combine these things. We could kind of stage and ladder the exit at different value points. That ended up being a really powerful design for them. They didn't get everything that they wanted out of it, but they were able to move past, by the way, they had been before they hired us to do this design, this sort of goal setting for them. They had been trying to do this for 10 years and they'd been absolutely unable to find any kind of peaceful resolution. They were just completely stuck. So through that education, through the design, we could take that design, align it not just with what they wanted to accomplish on the ownership side for their employees, for their management team, for their family, but we were also able to align all of this with their strategy because they needed to understand how to drive value across probably the next 15 years so that the people who were going to stay in the company could realize, could essentially manage their risk and realize the reward. Because, you know, look, there's an argument to be made that a bird in hand, if you can exit a company and you have that cash in your hand, it's not a bad idea. Running a private business is inherently risky. It's inherently hard to exit. So a lot of owners will make the choice to sell their business maybe before they really want to because, look, cash is investable. Investable assets are liquid and a private business is not. So they can de-risk personally through that process. But that's a good example. I know that's a little bit complex, but it's a good example of a hybrid exit strategy where we combined employee ownership management and family equity. Now, we did have to reorganize the company so that we could issue some new classes of equity that would be like the management team wouldn't have the same class as the family equity or the founder equity and the employee ownership. An ESOP has to be the top class of equity in the company. So that's where that went. So we had to kind of play around with the equity structure of the company to make all of it work. But that wasn't all that difficult to do. Once we had kind of the logic, the frame of the plan in place, then it's just execution. It's logistics and mechanics from that point forward. Now, Interestingly, and this was a good example of trying to manage as many risk scenarios as you possibly can at any given time, we finished that plan shortly before COVID here in the United States became a reality. The 62-year-old CEO, youngest of the brothers, was an avid motorcyclist. He would always go to like the Harley-Davidson rallies, you know, those big group rallies.
Right.
And he went and he got COVID and he passed away. Rather, like, suddenly went into the hospital and he never came out. So he was one of the earliest fatalities in the whole COVID in the United States, and certainly in his particular area. So that's going to scramble the picture, obviously, right? Because now they've lost arguably their most important employee, a guy who knew a lot about the company, and they hadn't done very much on the succession planning side. So they didn't have a clear replacement for him, and it was disruptive to the company. But you kind of stay the course, you do the best you can, you lean on family in that case, and they're longtime loyal employees, and they were able to get through it. And then they kind of held on to the company through COVID, and then now they've begun their exit process. So one of the key points to that story is we got them to put a stake in the ground and say, we're going to start this thing 2 years from today. We're going to start pulling the trigger on it, which was very important for them to agree to, because without that stake in the ground, it's difficult to design anything.
Wow, that's a great story. How long did you work with them on that?
We worked with them on the design for about 6 months and then left them with a roadmap and said, look, if you follow this roadmap, you're going to be okay. We really felt like they ran a great company, right? I mean, it had, every company has opportunities for improvement. But from our perspective, we were hired to create the transition design, right? The transition plan and to build that roadmap for them. Once that was finished, they ran their company. They grew their company. They continued to add value. In that situation, I didn't really feel like there was a need for us to continue to work for them. Although if they wanted us to do it, we were going to be there for them. If we had worked for them further on the value acceleration side, we would have started at the leadership team level. They just didn't have enough leadership to survive any kind of disruption. And unfortunately, that's how it played out. They also had some real struggles with financial systems. I mean, they were a $120 million company and they were still running off spreadsheets. They were trying to transition over to a new software platform and had been working on it for a couple of years, but it wasn't going very well. Their financial systems and their sort of operations technology was not where it needed to be. So there were obviously opportunities, but we did our job and then they were able to manage through the disruption well enough and start their process.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sean, we've covered a ton today. I really appreciate your time and generosity with your time this afternoon. And I think we covered a ton here talking about the current state of business owners and talking about various ways to accelerate enterprise value, talking about the different risks and value killers out there and ways to navigate an exit and everything in between there. So thank you for all that. So
yeah, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Well, good. Well, Sean, thank you again. Thank you to the audience out there. And if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us. In the meantime, we wish you all the best and be well. Thank you. On behalf of our entire team here at ATX Wealth Partners, we hope you enjoyed this program. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to email us at atxwealthpartners@ubs.com. And remember this, know your options, be informed, and plan early. Until next time, take care and be well.